Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight-up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Global from Asia. We're at episode 20 here. I'm still on my U.S. road trip for a social agent startup. I just got to Florida late last night, and I'm going to spend some time finally with my parents after a couple of years. Also, see my U.S. accountant and other kind of like catching up with mail stuff. So I think some of that will turn into podcast episodes. You know, a lot of us doing business overseas in Asia or Hong Kong do go back to their home country and do have things to take care of there. I think that's going to be a great episode to listen to. So yeah, we're in the year of the horse in the Chinese New Year, but mainland China is still just kind of getting off to a slower start. I think this week coming up, factories and offices should be getting back to work. Okay, and now today for our main feature, we have Tayan Patel, an experienced intellectual property lawyer based out of Washington, D.C. He's worked in the USPTO, or the United States Patent and Trademark Office, for many years, but now he's practicing at a for-profit firm. He's helped clients like me who are based outside of the U.S. obtain patents and trademarks for U.S. So I think that we're going to focus that topic today around people living and working overseas to get U.S. IP. Today's episode is kind of an overview. You know, it's really hard to kind of get deep into law and things like that in one podcast. So he's willing to do more. You know, we can do very more specific, in-depth of each piece. So, of course, that's also based on listener feedback. So if anything, let me know what you guys think. So let's just dive in. So we're here in Washington, D.C., with a good friend of mine all the way back in college, Tayan Patel. And thanks for being here, Ty.
Glad to be here, Michael.
Okay, great. So we just spent the day together, and I've been learning more about your business, what you do, but maybe you can just share with our listeners the introduction.
Sure, thanks, Mike. So in a nutshell, I'm an intellectual property attorney. I specialize in helping clients procure different forms of intellectual property rights, and not only procuring it, but also enforcing their rights against their competitors or potential infringers. Intellectual property, as many of your guests will probably know, is based off patents, trademarks, copyrights, and to some extent also trade secrets.
So I think just before the show, I learned that you focus mostly on patent law and patent filing.
Yeah, that is correct. You know, just a little background on how I came through to get into intellectual property. You know, during law school, I interned for a biomedical device company, Becton Dickinson and Company, and interned for their intellectual property department. After law school, I made the decision to work for the United States Patent and Trademark Office as a patent examiner. I understand trademarks very well. However, my specialty is patent preparation, prosecution, and litigation, coupled with licensing.
Yeah, because we both went to school for engineering. I think a lot of people we went to school with don't actually, you know, do engineering, and we, you know, we're all in different fields. And so I remember you went to law school, and then you worked in the USPTO, or the U.S. Patent Office, and now you're practicing for clients. So that's really interesting. So I think, you know, a lot of our listeners, our title of our show is Global from Asia. So a lot of them maybe have a Hong Kong company or a company that's not based in the U.S. or even with a U.S. address. So I think the first question is it possible for these kinds of companies to have U.S. IP or patents?
And the answer to that is absolutely. You know, I think companies abroad should understand that you do not need to be a U.S. company to have U.S. IP, and we're happy to help, especially myself.
Okay, great. And yeah, of course, we'll put your contact information on the show notes of the podcast so people can find that. So now that we've talked about, you know, American or overseas company or an Asian company being able to use the same, so it's exactly the same, it treated the same, and the costs are the same, maybe that would be another kind of follow-up. Is there any extra fees or, you know, mailing, it's all online, or?
Sure, yeah, I think that's a great question. There really isn't any additional fees to file trademarks if you're an overseas company. I think one of the main issues that I see from clients I've dealt with is understanding the legal terrain that comes along with trademarks in the United States, and particularly, you know, what you end up spending to procure those rights. You may not get exactly what you want unless you go with somebody who really understands how to deal with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, really understands, you know, your technology, brand, the sale of goods that you're trying to cover and then trying to procure those particular rights. Because at the end of the day, IP protection is only as good as what it covers. You know, you don't want just a paper trademark that's not really worth anything. The point of this is to entice others to either understand what your mark, your trademark covers, so that they're in a position where they would like to either purchase your trademark or understand what it covers and know the boundaries so that they do not, in essence, infringe your trademark.
Okay, got it. And then I think also we're talking about U.S., but I think a lot of people are always concerned about global. We're in a global economy now. So how does a U.S. patent help internationally, or is there some kind of window? I've also heard maybe there's a one-year window when you file in the U.S. to file internationally, or I know that people are always concerned about that.
Sure, yeah. Switching from trademarks to patents, just a brief definition of what a patent is. A patent is based on utility of an invention. So where a trademark is based on, let's say, the logo or the name, a patent is based on, for example, a device, you know, as simple as a table. A patent can also cover the function of what a table is used for. So perhaps patents give the owner the right to exclude others from making, using, selling, or importing that technology into the U.S. That's a U.S. patent. Other patents based on countries around the world have their own rights. So in this respect, the one-year rule for patents, just recently there was something called the American Invents Act, occurred in 2012, and based off of that, it was a harmonization of the U.S. patent rights with the rest of the world, going from what we have as a first-to-invent system, meaning when you actually conceived of the invention, to a first-to-file system, which is what is consistent with the rest of the world, particularly Europe, Japan, China, Korea, as the main IP markets around the world. And so the one-year rule is based on wherever you file, you have a year from that date to file a patent, an application for a patent, anywhere else in the world that claims priority to that first filed application. And this is based off of the Paris Treaty.
Getting pretty deep here. So then that's the first year of any patent anywhere in the world. They have that 1 year to go other countries. Okay, great.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just in a nutshell. You know, we can always explore this topic in, you know, a separate podcast, of course. You know, if any of the viewers or watchers have particular questions.
That'd be great. Of course, this is a huge subject, and to cover it in 15 or 20 minutes is a lot to ask. So we're just kind of, at least in this podcast, trying to give it like a high level idea. I guess one thing is, I've heard mixed reviews, you know, especially in Asia, like people are making all kinds of products, like in, you know, South China, there's all kinds of like consumer electronics coming out, and people say, is it worth patenting and time to file a patent versus this getting into the market, or what would you suggest? I guess a lot of people are smaller or medium-sized companies on our list, you know, they're not huge multinational firms, so what would you give them as advice? They have some kind of a new product idea of like a consumer electronic, and they want to sell it from Hong Kong or from China to the world, and they want to maybe protect their product idea.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And here, I think the emphasis based on the first-to-file system that is consistent around the world is that you really want to get your application, your technology, into an application filed with one of the patent offices as soon as possible. What that does is that secures you a filing date. And by doing that, you essentially exclude others who are trying to capitalize on perhaps your technology that may have a date later than you. So, but if you're developing a technology and you get to a point where that technology is of some worth and you find something that you consider to be a novel, patentable invention, patentable more is a legal inquiry that, you know, perhaps I could assist with, but when you think of something that's a new invention, you really want to get that filed with one of the patent offices as soon as possible.
Okay, makes sense. I know I'm almost positive somebody listening right now is kind of wondering a range of costs. I know it's so hard to put a number because there's somewhat of a range.
Yeah, I mean, it's a gray area. There's a hybrid between the type of technology we're dealing with. It can range anywhere from a mechanical application to something specific like a chemical composition to perhaps software. There's also other factors that are brought into this. It's, you know, how much help is being provided by the inventors or the company in terms of coming forward with information about the invention. A good patent attorney is able to take a broad concept from a client or a company and really flesh it out with details and provide you with an actual alternative embodiments that you wouldn't even think of, but are broad enough to cover your concept and also those that perhaps some of your potential infringers would, you know, consider to be valuable as an easy design around to get around your patent. So in terms of prices, let's say on a low end in the United States, and this is just working with clients, you know, we have small, medium, large, you know, they range anywhere from $8,500 for a very basic invention to, you know, upwards of $20,000 to $25,000 for preparation of the patent application and filing it with you, you know, with the United States Patent and Trademark Office or the European Patent Office or any other office around the world.
I'm glad you can put at least a number. I think that always helps people. They're always afraid of the costs involved. And I think sometimes that's why people don't even consider it until maybe it's almost too late.
Yeah, you know, and that's the interesting thing. You know, as you move over into intellectual property, you know, at the end of the day, it's intangible property, meaning property you can't actually see, but, you know, it's almost like owning tangible property, like a car. And so, with that being said, some of this intangible property still has a, you know, it's still a commodity, and every commodity has a price, it's, you know, depending on market factors. And so, you know, certain patent practitioners can work with clients depending on their budgets and, you know, and how much information they're provided. So it's always negotiable.
I think some people are afraid of like hourly, you know, open-ended when they work with professional services. Would you be able to like give a number at the beginning when you work with a client or?
Yeah, I mean, when you work with a client, you know, you should always be upfront with them about what your hourly rate is. But however, legal services these days are kind of moving over to a flat fee arrangement, kind of a high and a low number of, you know, what a client can, you know, expect to spend over the lifespan of the patent. And a good patent practitioner should be able to at least give you, you know, a low, a medium, and a high number, you know, for preparing the patent application, perhaps replying to any office actions that you will inevitably receive from the patent office, which is a reply to an examiner's rejection, which is inevitably always the case in patents. You know, sometimes, obviously, it's a 5% chance that, you know, you get a first action allowance on your technology. But patent practitioners, you know, should know what the cost should be.
I think also there's Kickstarter listeners. With Kickstarter, people list their product online and then customers can prepay, and then if they get enough orders, they can then manufacture it. So that helps a lot of inventors to kind of get over that hump of the initial investment of manufacturing the goods before they have validation in the market. So if they are doing such things as a Kickstarter or pre-selling a product, is it safe to do that first? What are your ideas there?
That's a gray area, especially elsewhere in the world. My advice is generally to file on your technology as soon as possible. There are some U.S. laws that are different from around the world where, for example, in Europe, you know, if you go to a trade show, for example, and you display your product and then you file an application, your own display at the trade show could potentially be used against you in obtaining future patent protection. You know, in the US, we've got some safeguards to that where you have, you know, a year from your own disclosure, public or through a third party, to then file for patent protection, and that your own disclosure would not be used against you as what we call prior art in order to, you know, produce a rejection by the patent office. So while the first to file system is being harmonized around the world, there are still slight differences among different jurisdictions, or we'll call them countries, around the world. And so, you know, my only advice is wherever you think you want to file for a patent, you really want to obtain some counsel, at least, from a competent patent practitioner.
Okay, that's interesting advice. So maybe to summarize, if I list on Kickstarter some new product idea and the public sees it, or I take it to a trade show to get interest, I have a year after that date to be able to start to file.
You know, and again, this depends on where you are in the world, because patent rights are specific to each jurisdiction. A jurisdiction is a country, such as the United States, such as a governing body over multiple states, which would be the European Patent Office, each having contracting states, including upward of 18 countries. But, you know, you also have China, and the rules are different everywhere. As a U.S. patent practitioner, I counsel generally my clients on U.S. patent law and their ability to procure rights in the United States. But I also deal with conflict of laws, especially patent laws, around the world. So in the United States, under the American Invents Act, if you were to go to a trade show and display your product, or a third party was to display your product, you would have a year to file a patent application on that specific technology. You know, if there's variations to that, that's a gray area again. And so with the American Invents Act being so new, you know, some of that has not been tested out yet before the courts.
Okay. I'm learning a lot already on this, and I've known for so many years and I'm learning today. So enforcement, you know, I think filing is one, and then enforcement is I think actually the real value of filing, right? So actually stopping others from in the market. That can obviously be like a 20-minute or an hour talk, but how do you suggest someone that sees their product idea in the market to react? Do they contact that person? Do they contact a lawyer, or what would you suggest?
So when you have a patent, your rights are confined to what's claimed. A patent application consists of different parts. You've got a background, a summary, a detailed description, and the legal portion of the patent application would be the claims. And so when you file a patent application and you have a certain set of claims, you have rights that are connected to those claims when you file. A patent, and this is the key distinction, while you may have patentable rights on a particular technology, the patent does not, and this is probably for another talk, and I'm happy if there is, you know, if people would like to talk about this, I'm happy to talk more about it later. A patent does not give you the right to practice your technology. I know that's counterintuitive, but as I mentioned before, a patent is the right to exclude others. And so there may be patents that in a broad way may cover your product. And so you may be able to exclude others from practicing a particular technology, but others may be able to exclude you from covering a particular technology, depending on how broad their claims are. And so it's kind of a song and dance that you play at the patent office, and it's very important to obtain a very good examination at the patent office and obtain broad claim coverage.
It's kind of like blocking others rather than owning or holding something yourself is blocking others.
Somebody is enjoining you from practicing your technology, and you're doing the same perhaps to somebody else. And so when there's two competitors that are in that same market, what they may end up doing is entering into a licensing agreement, which is called a cross license, where they understand for the greater good for both companies, they need to enter into an arrangement where they can both practice their own patents, but perhaps exclude everybody else in the market.
Okay, it's been very valuable. It's a little bit over our normal episode time, but I think it's definitely worthwhile for listeners. Maybe one point is a case study or an example, and maybe, I know you said you've worked with a few clients overseas, maybe you don't have to disclose their information, but give an example, and I think specific to somebody maybe in Hong Kong or overseas, because it's a little bit, maybe sometimes there's a worry of communication and a payment and just the culture of dealing with those clients, if you're comfortable.
Based on an experience that I've had with obtaining patents.
Helping with IP for an international client.
Patents are jurisdiction specific. It's important for a big company when they're trying to license their technology to someone else. But also, you know, when it comes to litigation, you know, you want to make sure that your coverages are similar. Sometimes as a manager of a worldwide portfolio, you would like to get as broad coverage as you want, but you don't want to make any misstatements. And so while managing the global portfolio, you want to ensure that you don't say more than you need to say. And so you need somebody that understands patent law in the US, understands patent law in China, understands patent law in Europe. And I know we may have a lot of Hong Kong listeners on the line. Something important to note is that, you know, you are able to obtain patent coverage into Hong Kong through two venues. You can go directly from the Republic of China and then obtain rights to Hong Kong, or you can actually obtain it through the European Patent Office, given that Hong Kong was at one time a British colony. And so it's good to have somebody that understands the patent landscape and the whole world in general, especially if you're trying to commercialize, because as we know, the world is getting smaller.
Part of this show too is that the world is getting flat, and you know, people are doing business globally around the world, and especially from Asia. So I think, you know, I'm very impressed with your explanations today. And best ways that listeners can talk to you or contact you is email or.
Yeah, I mean, email is probably the best way for an initial contact. And I mean, I check my email hourly, if not more than that. And always happy to arrange a phone call and assist any of the viewers that, you know, have issues and questions.
And we'll put that on the show notes for listeners today. So thanks for being with us, Ty-Ann. I call him Ty. I don't know if clients hopefully can call you by Ty-Ann or Ty.
Yeah, I think that's fine. You know, Ty or Ty-Ann, you know, at this point, it's really just trying to help, you know, the clients advance their technology.
Great. Okay, guys, and that's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you, Ty, for that. And so that's a wrap for episode 20. And as always, I always put some feedback from listeners. And I had a friend add on WeChat or Weixin mobile app, John, in Hong Kong doing e-commerce. He's a big fan of podcasts in general, and he stumbled across this podcast here, Global from Asia, and he reached out to me and said the following. Hey, I stumbled across your podcast. Listen to a few episodes. Keep up the good work. I'd like to hear the failure, challenge, obstacle experience as well, as it would be valuable and help me understand what not to do. Also, some revenue numbers, if possible, of these businesses that you're interviewing. Some topics that I'd like to hear are in logistics and hiring in Asia. Thanks, John. I think those are some great episode ideas, and I will, I actually know people in those industries, and I'll work on getting them on the show. Thanks again for tuning in, everybody, and have a great week ahead, and see you next week. Cheers.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.